Part 2. I woke to a wash of fog pressed against the windows, the bedroom filled with snowy light. It took a moment to reoccupy the disappointing and familiar facts. I was staying in Dan's house. It was his bureau in the corner, his glass-topped nightstand. His blanket, bordered in sateen ribbon, that I pulled over my own body. I remembered Julian and Sasha, the thin wall between us. I didn't want to think of the previous night, Sasha's mewlings, the slurred, obsessive muttering, "Fuck me, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me," repeated so many times it failed to mean anything. I stared at the monotony of ceiling. They'd been thoughtless, as all teenagers are, and the night didn't mean anything beyond that. Still, the polite thing to do was to wait in my room until they had left for Humboldt, let them clear off without having to perform any dutiful morning niceties. As soon as I heard the car back out of the garage, I got out of bed. The house was mine again, and though I expected relief, there was some sadness too. Sasha and Julian were aimed at another adventure, clicking back into the momentum of the larger world. I'd recede in their minds, the middle-aged woman in a forgotten house, just a mental footnote getting smaller and smaller as their real life took over. I hadn't realized until then how lonely I was. Or something less urgent than loneliness. An absence of eyes on me, maybe. Who would care if I ceased to exist? Those silly phrases I remembered Russell saying. "Cease to exist," he urged us. "Disappear the self." And all of us nodding like golden retrievers, the reality of our existence making us cavalier, eager to dismantle what seemed permanent. I started the kettle, opened the window to let a slash of cold air circulate. I gathered what seemed to be a lot of empty beer bottles. Had they drunk more while I slept? After taking out the trash, the tight heave of plastic and my own garbage, I caught myself staring at the pokey blankets of ice plants along the driveway. The beach beyond. The fog had started to burn off, and I could see the crawl of waves, the cliffs above, looking rusted and dry. A few people were out walking, obvious in performance wear. Most of them had dogs. This was the only beach around where you could take dogs off-leash. I'd seen the same Rottweiler a few times, his coat a color deeper than black, his heavy, churning run. A pit bull had recently killed a woman in San Francisco. Was it strange that people loved these creatures that could harm them? Or was it understandable that they maybe even loved animals more for their restraint, for the way they blessed humans with temporary safety? I hustled back inside. I couldn't stay in Dan's house forever. Another aid job would turn up soon. But how familiar that was, lifting someone into the warm, persistent waters of a therapy tub, sitting in the waiting rooms of doctors' offices, reading articles on the effects of soy on tumors, the importance of filling your plate with a rainbow, the usual wishful lies, tragic in their insufficiency. Did anyone really believe in them? As if the bright flash of your efforts could distract death from coming for you, keep the bull snorting harmlessly after the scarlet flag. The kettle was whistling, so at first I didn't hear Sasha come into the kitchen. Her abrupt presence startled me. "Morning," she said. A streak of spit had dried along her cheek. She was wearing high-cut shorts made of sweatpant material, her socks dotted with tiny hot pink symbols I realized were skulls. She swallowed, her mouth furry with sleep. "Where's Julian?" she asked. I tried to hide my surprise. "I heard the car leave a while ago," she squinted. "What?" she asked. "Didn't he tell you he was going?" Sasha saw my pity. Her face tightened. Of course he told me, she said after a moment. Yeah, of course. He'll be back tomorrow. So he had left her. My first thought was irritation. I wasn't a babysitter. Then relief. Sasha was a kid. She shouldn't go with him to Humboldt, ride an ATV through barbed wire checkpoints to some shithole tarp ranch in Garberville just to pick up a duffel bag of weed. I was even a little glad for her company. I don't like the drive anyway, Sasha said, gamely adapting to the situation. I get sick on those small roads. He drives so crazy, too. Super fast. She leaned up against the counter, yawning. Tired? I said. She told me that she had been trying polyphasic sleep, but had to quit. It was too weird, she said. Her nipples were apparent through her shirt. Polyphasic sleep, I said, pulling my own robe tight in a prudish surge. Thomas Jefferson did it. You sleep in hour bursts, like 6 times a day. And you're awake the rest of the time? Sasha nodded. It's kind of great, the first couple of days, but I crashed hard. It seemed like I'd never sleep normal again. I couldn't link the girl I'd overheard the night before to the girl in front of me, talking about sleep experiments. There's enough hot water in the kettle if you want some, I said. But Sasha shook her head. I don't eat in the mornings, like a ballerina. She glanced at the window, the sea a pewter sheet. Do you ever swim? It's really cold. I had only seen the occasional surfer venture into the waves, their bodies sheathed in neoprene, hoods over their heads. So, you've gone in? She asked. No. Sasha's face moved with sympathy, like I was missing out on some obvious pleasure. But no one swam, I thought, feeling protective of my life in this borrowed house, the local orbits of my days. There are sharks out there, too, I added. They don't really attack humans, Sasha said, shrugging. She was pretty, like a consumptive, eaten by an internal heat. I tried to spot some pornographic residue of the night before, but there was nothing. Her face as pale and blameless as a lesser moon. Sasha's proximity, even for the day, forced some normalcy. The built-in preventative of another person meant I couldn't indulge the animal feelings, couldn't leave orange peels in the kitchen sink. I dressed right after breakfast instead of haunting my robe all day, swiped on mascara from a mostly dried-up tube. These were the cogent human labors, the daily tasks that staved larger panics. But living alone had gotten me out of the habit. I didn't feel substantial enough to warrant this kind of effort. I'd last lived with someone years ago, a man who taught ESL classes at one of the sham colleges that advertised on bus stop benches. The students were mostly wealthy foreigners who wanted to design video games. It was surprising to think of him, of David, to remember a time when I imagined a life with another person. Not love, but the pleasant inertia that could substitute, the agreeable quiet that passed over us both in car rides, the way I'd once seen him look at me as we crossed a parking lot. But then it started, a woman who knocked on the apartment door at strange hours. An ivory hairbrush that had belonged to my grandmother went missing from the bathroom. I never told David certain things, so that whatever closeness we had was automatically corrupted, the grub twisting in the apple. My secret was sunk deep, but it was there. Maybe that was the reason it had happened, the other women. I had left open a space for such secrets. And how much could you ever know another person, anyway? I'd imagined that Sasha and I would spend the day in courteous silence, that Sasha would be as hidden as a mouse. She was polite enough, but soon her presence was obvious. I found the refrigerator door left open, filling the kitchen with an alien buzz. Her sweatshirt thrown on the table, a book about the Enneagram splayed on a chair. Music came loud from her room through tinny laptop speakers. It surprised me. She was listening to the singer whose plaintive voice had been the perpetual oral backdrop for a certain kind of girl I remembered from college. Girls already swampy with nostalgia. Girls who lit candles and stayed up late, kneading bread dough in dance-skin leotards and bare feet. I was used to encountering remnants. The afterburn of the 60s was everywhere in that part of California. Ragged blips of prayer flags in the oak trees, vans eternally parked in fields, missing their tires, older men in decorative shirts with common law wives. But those were the expected 60s ghosts. Why would Sasha have any interest? I was glad when Sasha changed the music. A woman singing over gothy electronic piano. Nothing I recognized at all. That afternoon, I tried to take a nap, but I couldn't sleep. I lay there, staring at the framed photo that hung over the bureau. A sand dune, rippling with mint grass. The ghoulish whirls of cobwebs in the corners. I shifted in the sheets, impatient. I was too aware of Sasha in the room next door. The music from her laptop hadn't stopped all afternoon, and sometimes I could make out scraps of digital noise over the songs, beeps and chimes. What was she doing? Playing games on her phone? Texting with Julian? I had a sudden ache for the obliging ways she must be tending to her loneliness. I knocked on her door, but the music was too loud. I tried again. Nothing. I was embarrassed by the exposure of effort, about to scurry back to my room, but Sasha appeared in the doorway, her face still muted with sleep, her hair scraggled by the pillow. Maybe she'd been trying to nap too. "Do you want some tea?" I asked. It took her a moment to nod, like she'd forgotten who I was. Sasha was quiet at the table, studying her fingernails, sighing with cosmic boredom. I remembered this pose from my own adolescence, thrusting my jaw forward, staring out the car window like a wrongfully accused prisoner, all along desperately wishing that my mother would say something. Sasha was waiting for me to breach her reserve, to ask her questions, and I could feel her eyes on me while I poured the tea. It was nice to be watched, even suspiciously. I used the good cups, and the buckwheat crackers I fanned along the saucers were only a little stale. I wanted to please her, I realized, setting the plate gently in front of her. The tea was too hot. There was a lull while we huddled over the cups, my face dampening in the thin, vegetal steam. When I asked Sasha where she was from, she grimaced. "Concord," she said. "It sucks." "And you go to college with Julian?" "Julian's not in college." I wasn't sure if this was information Dan knew. I tried to remember what I'd last heard. When Dan did mention his son, it was with performative resignation, playing the clueless dad. Any trouble reported with sitcom sighs. Boys will be boys. Julian had been diagnosed with some behavioral disorder in high school, though Dan made it sound mild. "Have you guys been together long?" I asked. Sasha sipped at the tea. "A few months," she said. Her face grew animate, like just talking about Julian was a source of sustenance. She must have already forgiven him for leaving her behind. Girls were good at coloring in those disappointing blank spots. I thought of the night before, her exaggerated moans, Poor Sasha. She probably believed that any sadness, any flicker of worry over Julian, was just a problem of logistics. Sadness at that age had the pleasing texture of imprisonment. You reared and sulked against the bonds of parents and school and age, the things that kept you from the certain happiness that awaited. When I was a sophomore in college, I had a boyfriend who spoke breathlessly of running away to Mexico. It didn't occur to me that we could no longer run away from home. Nor did I imagine what we would be running to, beyond the vagueness of warm air and more frequent sex. And now I was older, and the wishful props of future selves had lost their comforts. I might always feel some form of this, a depression that did not lift but grew compact and familiar, a space occupied like the sad limbo of hotel rooms. "Listen," I said, slotting into a parental role that was laughably unearned. "I hope Julian is being nice to you."
"Why wouldn't he be nice?" she said. "He's my boyfriend. We live together."
I could imagine so easily what would pass for living. A month-to-month apartment that smelled of freezer meals and Clorox. Julian's childhood comforter on the mattress. The girlish effort of a scented candle by the bed. Not that I was doing much better.
"We might get a place with a washing machine," Sasha said, a new defiance in her tone as she invoked their meager domesticity. "Probably in a few months."
"And your parents are okay with you living with Julian?"
"I can do what I want." She shuffled her hands into the sleeves of Julian's sweatshirt. "I'm 18.
That couldn't be true.
"Besides," she said, "weren't you my age when you were in that cult?"
Her tone was blank, but I imagined a slant of accusation. Before I could say anything, Sasha got up from the table, listing toward the refrigerator. I watched her affected swagger, the easy way she removed one of the beers they'd brought, the cut-out silvered mountains gleaming from the label. She met my gaze.
"Want one?" she asked.
This was a test, I understood. Either I could be the kind of adult to be ignored or pitied, or I could be someone she could maybe talk to. I nodded, and Sasha relaxed.
"Think fast," she said, tossing the bottle to me.
Night came on quick, as it did on the coast, with no mediation of buildings to temper the change. The sun was so low that we could look directly at it, watching it drift from sight. We each had had a few beers. The kitchen grew dark, but neither of us got up to turn on the lights. Everything had a blue shadow, soft and royal, the furniture simplifying into shapes. Sasha asked if we could make a fire in the fireplace.
"It's gas," I said, "and it's broken."
A lot of things in the house were broken or forgotten. The kitchen clock stopped, a closet doorknob coming off in my hand, the sparkly mess of flies I'd swept from the corners. It took sustained, constant living to ward off decay. Even my presence for the last few weeks hadn't made much of a dent.
"But we can try making one out in the yard," I said.
The sandy lot behind the garage was sheltered from the wind, wet leaves matted on the seats of plastic chairs. There had once been a fire pit of sorts, the stones scattered among the senseless archaeological relics of family life. Add-ons to forgotten toys, a chewed-looking shard of frisbee. We were both distracted by the hustle of preparation, tasks that allowed for companionable silence. I found a stack of three-year-old newspapers in the garage and a bundle of wood from the general store in town. Sasha towed the stones back into a circle. I was always bad at this, I said. There's something you're supposed to do, right? Some special shape with the logs?
Like a house, Sasha said. You're supposed to make it look like a cabin.
She used her foot to neaten the ring.
We used to camp a lot in Yosemite when I was little.
Sasha was the one who actually got the fire going, squatting in the sand, keeping up a steady stream of breath, gentling the flames until there was a satisfying burn. We sat down in the plastic chairs, their surfaces stippled from sand and wind. I pulled mine close to the fire. I wanted to feel hot, to sweat. Sasha was quiet, looking at the jump of flames, but I could sense the whir of her mind, the faraway place she had disappeared to. Maybe she was imagining what Julian was doing up in Garberville, the musky futon he'd sleep on, using a towel for a blanket, all part of the adventure. How nice it must be to be a 20-year-old boy.
That stuff Julian was talking about, Sasha said, clearing her throat like she was embarrassed, though her interest was obvious. Were you, like, in love with that guy or something?
Russell? I said, poking at the fire with a stick. I didn't think about him like that. It was true. The other girls had circled around Russell, tracking his movements and moods like weather patterns, but he stayed mostly distant in my mind, like a beloved teacher whose home life his students never imagined.
Why'd you hang out with them, then? She asked.
My first impulse was to avoid the subject. I'd have to pin down all the edges, act out the whole morality play, the regret, the warnings. I tried to sound businesslike.
People were falling into that kind of thing all the time back then, I said. Scientology, the process people, empty chair work. Is that still a thing?
I glanced at her. She was waiting for me to go on. It was partly bad luck, I guess, that it was the group I found.
But you stayed.
I could feel the full force of Sasha's curiosity for the first time.
There was a girl.
It was more her than Russell. I hesitated.
Suzanne.
It was odd to say her name, to let it live in the world.
She was older, I said. Not by much, really, but it felt like a lot.
Suzanne Parker?
I stared across the fire at Sasha.
I looked some things up today, she said. Online.
I'd once lost hours to that kind of stuff. The fan sites, or whatever you called them. The stranger corners. The website devoted to Suzanne's artwork from prison. Watercolors of mountain ranges. Puffball clouds. The captions filled with misspellings. I'd felt a pang imagining Suzanne working with great concentration, but closed the website when I saw the photo. Suzanne in blue jeans and a white t-shirt, her jeans stuffed with middle-aged fat, her face a vacant scrim. The thought of Sasha gorging on that macabre glut made me uneasy, packing herself with particulars, the autopsy reports, the testimony the girls gave of that night, like the transcript of a bad dream. It's nothing to be proud of, I said, recounting the usual things. It was awful, not glamorous, not enviable.
There wasn't anything about you, Sasha said. Not that I could find.
I felt a lurch. I wanted to tell her something valuable, my existence traced with enough care that I would become visible.
It's better that way, I said,
so the lunatics don't search me out.
But you were there?
I lived there, basically, for a while. I didn't kill anyone or anything. My laugh came out flat. Obviously. She was huddling into her sweatshirt.
You just left your parents?
Her voice was admiring.
It was a different time, I said. Everyone ran around. My parents were divorced.
So are mine, Sasha said, forgetting to be shy.
And you were my age?
A little younger.
I bet you were really pretty. I mean, duh, you're pretty now, too, she said.
I could see her puff up with her own generosity.
How'd you even meet them? Sasha asked.
It took me a moment to gather myself, to remember the sequence of things. Revisit is the word they always used in anniversary articles about the murder. Revisiting the horror of Edgewater Road. As if the event existed singularly, a box you could close a lid on. As if I hadn't been stopped by hundreds of ghosted Suzannes on the streets or in the background of movies. I fielded Sasha's questions about what they had been like in real life, those people who had become totems of themselves. Guy had been less interesting to the media, just a man doing what men had always done. But the girls were made mythic. Donna was the unattractive one, slow and rough, often cast as a pity case. The hungry harshness in her face. Helen, the former campfire girl, tan and pigtailed and pretty. She was the fetish object, the pin-up murderess. But Suzanne got the worst of it. Depraved. Evil. Her sneaky beauty didn't photograph well. She looked feral and meager, like she might have existed only to kill. Talking about Suzanne raised a rev in my chest that I was sure Sasha could see. It seemed shameful to feel that helpless excitement, considering what had happened. The caretaker on the couch, the coiled casing of his guts exposed to the air. The mother's hair soaked with gore. The boy so disfigured the police weren't sure of his gender. Surely Sasha had read about those things, too.
Did you ever think you could have done what they did? She asked.
Of course not, I said reflexively. In all the times I had ever told anyone about the ranch, few had ever asked me that question. Whether I could have done it too. Whether I almost had. Most assumed a base level of morality separated me, as if the girls had been a different species. Sasha was quiet. Her silence seemed like a kind of love. I guess I do wonder sometimes, I said. It seems like an accident that I didn't.
An accident?
The fire was getting weak and jumpy. There wasn't that much difference between me and the other girls. It was strange to say this aloud, to edge even vaguely around the worry I had worked over all this time. Sasha didn't seem disapproving or even wary. She simply looked at me, her watchful face on mine, as if she could take in my words and make a home for them. We went to the one bar in town that had food. This seemed like a good idea, a goal we could aim toward. Sustenance. Movement. We'd talked until the fire had burned itself into a glowy mottle of newspaper. Sasha kicked sand over the mess, her scout's diligence making me laugh. I was happy to be with someone, despite the provisional reprieve. Julian would come back, Sasha would be gone, and I'd be alone again. Even so, it was nice to be the subject of someone's admiration, because that's what it was, mostly. Sasha seemed to respect the 14-year-old girl I had been, to think I was interesting, had been somehow brave. I tried to correct her, but an expansive comfort had spread in my chest, a reoccupation of my body, like I'd woken from the twilight of pharmaceutical sleep. We walked side by side on the shoulder of the road along the aqueduct. The pointed trees were dense and dark, but I didn't feel afraid. The night had taken on a strange, festive air, and Sasha had started calling me V for some reason.
Mama V, she said.
She seemed like a kitten, affable and mild, her warm shoulder bumping against mine. When I looked over, I saw that she was gnawing on her bottom lip, her face turned to the sky. But there was nothing to see. The stars were hidden by fog. There were a few stools in the bar, and not much else. The usual patchwork of rusted signs, a pair of humming neon eyes over the door. Someone in the kitchen was smoking cigarettes. The sandwich bread was humid with smoke. We stayed a while after we'd finished eating. Sasha looked 15, but they didn't care. The bartender, a woman in her 50s, seemed grateful for any business. She looked worked over, her hair crispy from drugstore dye. We were almost the same age, but I wouldn't glance into the mirror to confirm the similarities, not with Sasha beside me. Sasha, whose features had the clean, purified cast of a saint on a religious medal. Sasha swiveled around on her stool like a young child.
Look at us, she laughed. Partying hard.
She took a drink of beer, then a drink of water, a conscientious habit I'd noticed, though it didn't prevent a visible slump from taking over.
I'm kind of glad Julian's not here, she said.
The words seemed to thrill her. I knew by then not to spook her, but instead to give her space to dawdle toward her actual point. Sasha kicked the bar rail absently, her breath beery and close.
He didn't tell me he was leaving, she said. For Humboldt?
I pretended surprise. She laughed flatly.
I couldn't find him this morning, and I just thought he was, like, outside. That's kind of weird, right? That he just took off?
Yeah, weird. Too cautious, maybe, but I was wary of inciting a righteous defense of Julian.
He texted me all sorry. He thought we'd talked about it, I guess.
She sipped her beer, drawing a smiley face in the wood of the bar with a wet finger.
You know why he got kicked out of Irvine?
She was half giddy, half wary.
Wait, she said. You're not going to tell his dad, are you?
I shook my head, an adult willing to keep a teenager's secrets.
Okay. Sasha took a breath. He had some comp teacher he hated. He was kind of a jerk, I guess. The teacher. He didn't let Julian turn in this paper late, even though he knew Julian would fail without a grade for it. So Julian went to the guy's house and did something to his dog. Fed him something that made him sick, like bleach or rat poison. I don't really know what.
Sasha caught my eye.
The dog died. This old dog.
I struggled to keep my face even. The plainness of her retelling, devoid of any inflection, made the story worse.
The school knew he did it, but they couldn't prove it, Sasha said. So they suspended him for other stuff. But he couldn't go back or anything. It's messed up.
She looked at me.
I mean, don't you think?
I didn't know what to say.
He said he didn't mean to kill it or anything. Just make it sick.
Sasha's tone was tentative, testing out the thought.
That's not so bad, right?
I don't know, I said. It sounds bad to me.
But I live with him, you know, Sasha said. Like, he pays all the rent and stuff.
There are always places to go, I said.
Poor Sasha. Poor girls.
The world fattens them on the promise of love. How badly they need it, and how little most of them will ever get. The treacled pop songs, the dresses described in the catalogs with words like sunset and Paris. Then the dreams are taken away with such violent force. The hand wrenching the buttons of the jeans. Nobody looking at the man shouting at his girlfriend on the bus. Sorrow for Sasha locked up my throat. She must have sensed my hesitation.
Whatever, she said. It was a while ago.
This is what it might be like to be a mother, I thought, watching Sasha drain her beer, wipe her mouth like a boy. To feel this unexpected, boundless tenderness for someone, seemingly out of nowhere. When a pool player sauntered over, I was prepared to scare him away. But Sasha smiled big, showing her pointed teeth.
Hi, she said.
And then he was buying us each another beer. Sasha drank steadily, alternating between distracted boredom and manic interest, feigned or not, in what the man was saying.
You two from out of town?
He asked, his hair graying and long, a turquoise ring on his thumb, another 60s ghost. Maybe we'd even crossed paths back then, haunting the same well-worn trail. He hitched up his pants.
Sisters?
His voice barely tried to include me in the purview of his effort, and I almost laughed. Still, even sitting next to Sasha, I was aware of some of the attention washing onto me. It was shocking to remember the voltage, even secondhand. How it felt to be a desired thing. Maybe Sasha was so used to it that she didn't even notice. Caught up in the rush of her own life. In her certainty of the meliorative trajectory.
She's my mother, Sasha said. Her eyes were taut, wanting me to keep the joke going.
And I did. I huddled my arm around her. We're on a mother-daughter trip, I said, driving the one, all the way up to Eureka.
Adventurers, the man exclaimed, pounding the table.
His name was Victor, we learned, and the background wallpaper on Victor's cell phone was an Aztec image, he told us, so imbued with powers that just the contemplation of said image made you smarter. He was convinced that world events were orchestrated by complicated and persistent conspiracies. He took out a dollar bill to show us how the Illuminati communicated with one another. Why would a secret society lay out their plans on common currency? I asked. He nodded, like he'd anticipated the question.
To display the reach of their power.
I envied Victor's certainty. The idiot syntax of the righteous. This belief that the world had a visible order and all we had to do was look for the symbols, as if evil were a code that could be cracked. He kept talking, his teeth wet from drink, the gray blush of a dead molar. He had plenty of conspiracies to explain to us in detail, plenty of inside information he could clue us into. He spoke of getting on the level, of hidden frequencies and shadow governments.
Wow, Sasha said, deadpan. Did you know that, Mom?
She kept calling me Mom, her voice exaggerated and comical, though it took me a while to see how drunk she was, to realize how drunk I was, too. The night had sailed into foreign waters. The fritzing of the neon signs, the bartender smoking in the doorway. I watched the bartender stamp the butt out, her flip-flops sliding around her feet. Victor said it was nice to see how well Sasha and I got along.
You don't always see that, these days.
He nodded, thoughtful.
Mothers and daughters who take a trip together, who are sweet with each other, like you two.
Oh, she's great, Sasha said. I love my mom.
She cut me a tricky smile before she leaned her face close to mine. The dry press of her lips, the stingy brine of pickles on her mouth, the most chaste of kisses. Still, Victor was shocked, as she'd hoped he would be.
God damn, Victor said, both disgusted and titillated,
straightening his bulky shoulders, retucking his blousy shirt.
He suddenly seemed wary of us, glancing around for support, for confirmation, and I wanted to explain that Sasha wasn't my daughter, but I was past the point of caring, the night stoking a foolish, confused sense that I had somehow returned to the world after a period of absence, had taken up residence again in the realm of the living.
1969. 6. My father had always been in charge of pool maintenance, skimming the surface with a net, heaping wet leaves into a pile. The colored vials he used to test chlorine levels. He'd never been that assiduous with upkeep, but the pool had gotten bad since he'd left. Salamanders idling around the filter. When I propelled myself along the rim, there was some sloggy resistance, crud dispersing in my wake. My mother was at group. She'd forgotten a promise to buy me a new swimsuit, so I was wearing my old orange one, pale as cantaloupe, the stitching puckered and gaping around the leg holes. The top was too small, but the adult mass of cleavage pleased me. It had only been a week since the solstice party, and already I'd been back to the ranch, and already I was stealing money for Suzanne, bill by bill. I like to imagine that it took more time than that, that I had to be convinced over a period of months, slowly broken down, wooed as carefully as a valentine. But I was an eager mark, anxious to offer myself. I kept bobbing in the water, algae speckling the hair on my legs like filings to a magnet. A forgotten paperback ruffled on the seat of a lawn chair. The leaves in the trees were silvery and spangled, like scales, everything full with June's lazy heat. Had the trees around my house always looked like that, so strange and aquatic? Or were things already shifting for me? The dumb litter of the normal world, transforming into the lush stage sets of a different life. Suzanne had driven me home the morning after the solstice, my bike shoved in the back seat. My mouth was leached and unfamiliar from smoking so much, and my clothes were stale from my body and smelled of ash. I kept picking bits of straw from my hair, proof of the night before that thrilled me like a stamped passport. It had happened, after all, and I kept up a vivid catalog of happy data. The fact that I was sitting beside Suzanne, our friendly silence. My perverse pride that I'd been with Russell. I took pleasure in replaying the facts of the act, even the messy and boring parts. The odd lulls while Russell made himself hard. There was some power in the bluntness of human functions. Like Russell had explained to me, your body could hurtle you past your hang-ups, if you let it. Suzanne smoked steadily as she drove, occasionally offering her cigarette to me with serene ritual. The quiet between us wasn't slack or uncomfortable. Outside the car, olive trees flashed by, the scorched summer earth. Far-off waterways sloughing to the sea. Suzanne kept changing the radio station until she abruptly snapped it off. "We need gas," she announced. "We," I echoed silently, "we need gas." Suzanne pulled into the Texaco, empty except for a teal and white pickup towing a boat trailer. "Hand me a card," Suzanne said, nodding at the glove box. I scrambled to open it, loosing a jumble of credit cards, all with different names. "The blue one," she said. She seemed impatient. When I handed her the card, she saw my confusion. "People give them to us," she said. "Or we take them." She fingered the blue card. "Like this one is Donna's. She lifted it from her mom." "Her mom's gas card?"
saved our ass. We would have starved, Suzanne said. She gave me a look. Like you hustling that toilet paper, right?
I flushed at the mention. Maybe she'd known I'd lied, but I couldn't tell from her shuttered face. Maybe not.
Besides, she continued, it's better than what they'd do with it. More crap, more stuff, more me, me, me. Russell's trying to help people. He's not judgmental. That's not his trip. He doesn't care if you're rich or poor.
It made a kind of sense, what Suzanne was saying. They were just trying to equalize the forces in the world.
It's ego, she went on, leaning against the car but keeping a sharp eye on the gas gauge.
None of them ever filled up a tank more than a quarter full.
Money is ego, and people won't give it up. Just want to protect themselves, hold on to it like a blanket. They don't realize it keeps them slaves. It's sick.
She laughed.
What's funny is that as soon as you give everything away, as soon as you say, here, take it, that's when you really have everything.
One of the group had been detained for dumpster diving on a garbage run, and Suzanne was incensed, recounting the story as she pulled the car back onto the road.
More and more stores get wise to it. Bullshit, she said. They throw something away, and they still want it? That's America.
That is bullshit. The tone of the word was strange in my mouth.
We'll figure something out. Soon.
She glanced in the rear view.
Money's tight, but you just can't escape it.
You probably don't know what that's like. She wasn't sneering, not really. She spoke like she was just stating the truth, acknowledging reality with an affable shrug. That's when the idea came to me, fully formed as if I had thought of it myself. And that's how it seemed, like the exact solution, a baubled ornament shining within reach.
I can get some money, I said, later cringing at my eagerness. My mom leaves her purse out all the time.
It was true. I was always coming across money, in drawers, on tables, forgotten by the bathroom sink. I had an allowance, but my mother often gave me more, by accident, or just gestured vaguely in the direction of her purse.
Take what you need, she'd always said.
And I'd never taken more than I should have, and was always conscious of returning the change.
Oh, no, Suzanne said, flicking the last of her cigarette out the window. You don't have to do that. You're a sweet kid, though, she said. Nice of you to offer. I want to.
She pursed her lips, affecting uncertainty, igniting a tilt in my gut.
I don't want you to do something you don't want to. She laughed a little. That's not what I'm about.
But I do want to, I said. I want to help. Suzanne didn't speak for a minute, then smiled without looking over.
Okay, she said.
I didn't miss the test in her voice.
You want to help? You can help.
My task made me a spy in my mother's house. My mother, the clueless quarry. I could even apologize for our fight when I ran into her that night across the stillness of the hallway. My mother gave a little shrug, but accepted my apology, smiling in a brave way. It would bother me, normally, that wavery, brave smile. But the new me bowed my head in abject regret. I was imitating a daughter, acting like a daughter would. Part of me thrilled at the knowledge I held out of her reach, how every time I looked at her or spoke to her, I was lying. The night with Russell, the ranch, the secret space I tended to the side. She could have the husk of my old life, all the dried up leftovers. "You're home so early," she said. "I thought you might sleep at Connie's again."
"I didn't feel like it."
It was strange to be reminded of Connie, to jar back to the regular world. I'd been surprised, even, that I could feel the ordinary desire for food. I wanted the world to reorder itself visibly around the change, like a mend marking a tear. My mother softened.
"I'm just glad because I wanted to spend some time with you. Just us."
"It's been a while, huh?" "Maybe I'll make stroganoff," she said.
"Or meatballs. What do you think?"
I was suspicious of her offer. She didn't buy food for the house unless I wrote notes for her to find when she got back from group. And we hadn't eaten meat in forever. Sal told my mother that to eat meat was to eat fear, and that ingesting fear would make you gain weight.
"Meatballs would be good," I allowed.
I didn't want to notice how happy it made her. My mother turned on the radio in the kitchen, playing the kind of slight, balmy songs that I'd loved as a child. Diamond rings, cool streams, apple trees. If Suzanne or even Connie caught me listening to that sort of music, I'd be embarrassed. It was bland and cheerful and old-fashioned, but I had a grudging, private love of those songs, my mother singing along to the parts she knew. Rosy with theatrical enthusiasm, so it was easy to get caught up in her giddiness. Her posture was shaped by years of horse shows in adolescence, smiling from the backs of sleek Arabians, arena lights, catching the crust of rhinestones on her collar. She had been so mysterious to me when I was younger. The shyness I had felt watching her move around the house, shuffling in her night slippers. The drawer of jewelry whose provenance I made her describe, piece by piece, like a poem. The house was clean, the windows segmenting the dark night, the carpets plush beneath my bare feet. This was the opposite of the ranch, and I sensed I should be guilty, that it was wrong to be comfortable like this, to want to eat this food with my mother in the primness of our tidy kitchen. What were Suzanne and the others doing at that same moment? It was suddenly hard to imagine.
"How's Connie these days?" she asked, flicking through her handwritten recipe cards.
"Fine." She probably was, watching May Lopes's braces scum up.
"You know," she said, "she can always come over here. You guys have been spending an awful lot of time at her house lately."
"Her dad doesn't care."
"I miss her," she said, though my mother had always seemed mystified by Connie, like a barely tolerated maiden aunt. "We should go on a trip to Palm Springs or something."
It was clear she'd been waiting to offer this.
"You could invite Connie, if you want it."
"I don't know." "It could be nice. Connie and I, shoving each other in the sun-stifled back seat, drinking shakes from the date farm outside Indio."
"Hmm,"
she murmured.
"We could go in the next few weeks. But you know, sweetheart..."
A pause.
"Frank might come, too."
"I am not going on a trip with you and your boyfriend."
She tried to smile, but I saw that she wasn't saying everything. The radio was too loud.
"Sweetheart," she started,
"how are we ever going to live together?"
"What?" I hated how automatically my voice tilted bratty, cutting any authority.
"Not right away, definitely not," her mouth puckered. "But if Frank moves in..."
"I live here, too," I said. "You are just going to let him move in one day? Without even telling me?"
"You're 14.
"This is bullshit."
"Hey,
watch it," she said, tucking her hands into her armpits.
"I don't know why you're being so rude, but you need to quit it, and fast."
The nearness of my mother's pleading face, her naked upset, it stoked a biological disgust for her, like when I smelled the bellow of iron in the bathroom and knew she had her period.
This is a nice thing I'm trying to do, she said, inviting your friend along. Can I get a break here?
I laughed, but it was dripping with the sickness of betrayal. That's why she'd wanted to make dinner. It was worse now, because I'd been so easily pleased. Frank's an asshole. Her face flared, but she pushed herself to get calm. Watch your attitude. This is my life, understand? I'm trying to get just a little bit happy, she said. And you need to give me that. Can you give me that?
She deserved her anemic life, its meager, girlish uncertainties.
Fine, I said. Fine. Good luck with Frank.
Her eyes narrowed.
What does that mean?
Forget it. I could smell the raw meat coming to room temperature, a biting tinge of cold metal. My stomach tightened.
I'm not hungry anymore, I said, and left her standing in the kitchen,
the radio still playing songs about first loves, about dancing by the river. The meat thawed enough so that my mother would be forced to cook it, though no one would eat it. It was easy after that to tell myself that I deserved the money. Russell said that most people were selfish, unable to love, and that seemed true of my mother and my father, too, tucked away with Tamar in the Portofino apartments in Palo Alto. So it was a tidy trade when I thought about it like that, like the money I was filching, bill by bill, added up to something that could replace what had gone missing. It was too depressing to think it had maybe never been there in the first place. That none of it had. Connie's friendship. Peter ever feeling anything for me besides annoyance at the obviousness of my kiddish worship. My mother left her purse lying around, like always, and that made the money inside seem less valuable, something she didn't care enough about to take seriously. Still, it was uncomfortable poking around in her purse, like the rattly inside of my mother's brain. The litter was too personal. The wrapper from a butterscotch candy, a mantra card, a pocket mirror, a tube of cream the color of a Band-Aid that she patted under her eyes. I pinched a 10, folding it into my shorts. Even if she saw me, I'd just say I was getting groceries. Why would she suspect me? Her daughter, who had always been good, even if that was more disappointing than being great. I'm surprised that I felt so little guilt. On the contrary, there was something righteous in the way I hoarded my mother's money. I was picking up some of the ranch bravado, the certainty that I could take what I wanted. The knowledge of the hidden bills allowed me to smile at my mother the next morning, to act like we hadn't said the things we'd said the night before, to stand patiently when she brushed at my bangs without warning. Don't hide your eyes, my mother said, her breath close and hot, her fingers raking at my hair. I wanted to shake her off, to step back, but I didn't. There, she said, pleased. There's my sweet daughter. I was thinking of the money while I kicked in the pool, my shoulders above the waterline. There was a purity to the task, amassing the bills in my little zip purse. When I was alone, I liked to count the money, each new 5 or 10 a particular boon. I folded the crisper bills on top, so the bundle looked nicer. Imagining Suzanne's and Russell's pleasure when I brought the money to them, lulled into the sweet, wayward fog of daydreams. My eyes were closed as I floated, and I only opened them when I heard thrashing beyond the tree line. A deer, maybe? I tensed, stirring uneasily in the water. I didn't think that it could be a person. We didn't worry about those kinds of things. Not until later. And it was a Dalmatian, anyway, the creature that came trotting out of the trees and right up to the pool's edge. He regarded me soberly, then started to bark. The dog was strange-looking, speckled and spotted, and it barked with high, human alarm. I knew it belonged to the neighbors on our left, the Dutton family. The father had written some movie theme song, and at parties I had heard the mother hum it mockingly, to a gathered group. Their son was younger than me. He often shot his BB gun in the yard, the dog yelping in agitated chorus. I couldn't remember the dog's name. "Get," I said, splashing half-heartedly. I didn't want to have to haul myself out of the water.
"Go on."
The dog kept barking.
"Go."
I tried again, but the dog just barked louder. My cutoffs were damp from my swimsuit by the time I made it to the Dutton house. I'd put on my cork sandals, grimed with the ghost of my feet, and taken the dog by the collar, the ends of my hair dripping. Teddy Dutton answered the door. He was 11 or 12, his legs studded with scabs and scrapes. He'd broken his arm last year, falling from a tree, and my mother had been the one to drive him to the hospital. She'd muttered darkly that his parents left him alone too much. I had never spent much time with Teddy, beyond the familiarity of being young at neighborhood parties, anyone under age 18 herded together in a forced march to friendship. Sometimes I'd see him riding his bike along the fire road with a boy in glasses. He'd once let me pet a barn kitten they'd found, holding the tiny thing under his shirt. The kitten's eyes were leaky with pus, but Teddy had been gentle with it, like a little mother. That was the last time I'd spoken to him. "Hey," I said when Teddy opened the door, "your dog." Teddy was gaping at me like we hadn't been neighbors our whole lives. I rolled my eyes a little at his silence. "He was in our yard," I went on. The dog moved against my hold. It took Teddy a second to speak, but before he did, I saw him cut a helpless look at my swimsuit top, the exaggerated swell of cleavage. Teddy saw that I had noticed and got more flustered. He scowled at the dog, taking his collar. "Bad Tiki," he said, hustling the animal into the house. "Bad dog." The thought that Teddy Dutton might be somehow nervous around me was a surprise. Though I hadn't even owned a bikini the last time I'd seen him, and my breasts were bigger now, pleasing even to me, I found his attention almost hilarious. A stranger had once shown Connie and me his dick by the movie theater bathrooms. It had taken a moment to understand why the man was gasping like a fish for air. But then I saw his penis, out of his zipper like an arm out of a sleeve. He'd looked at us like we were butterflies he was pinning to a board. Connie had grabbed my arm, and we'd turned and run, laughing, the raisinettes clutched in my hand starting to melt. We recounted our disgust to each other in strident tones, but there was pride, too. Like the satisfied way Patricia Bell had once asked me after class, whether I'd seen how Mr. Garrison had been staring at her. And didn't I think it was weird? "His paws are all wet," I said. "He's gonna mess up the floors." "My parents aren't home. It doesn't matter." Teddy stayed in the doorway, awkward with an air of expectancy. Did he think we were going to hang out? He stood there, like the unhappy boys who sometimes got erections at the chalkboard for no reason at all. He was obviously under the command of some other force. Maybe the proof of sex was visible on me in a new way. "Well," I said. I worried I would start laughing. Teddy looked so uncomfortable. "See you." Teddy cleared his throat, trying to throttle his voice deeper. "Sorry," he said, "if Tiki was bothering you." How did I know I could mess with Teddy? Why did my mind range immediately to that option? I'd only been to the ranch twice since the solstice party, but I'd already started to absorb certain ways of seeing the world, certain habits of logic. Society was crowded with straight people, Russell told us. People in paralyzed thrall to corporate interests and docile as dosed lab chimps. Those of us at the ranch functioned on a whole other level, fighting against the miserable squall. And so what if you had to mess with the straight people to achieve larger goals, larger worlds? If you checked yourself out of that old contract, Russell told us, refused all the bullshit scare tactics of civics class and prayer books and the principal's office, you'd see there was no such thing as right and wrong. His permissive equations reduced these concepts to hollow relics, like medals from a regime no longer in power. I asked Teddy for a drink. Lemonade, I figured, soda. Anything but what he brought me, his hand shaking nervously when he passed me the glass. "Do you want a napkin?" he said. "Nah." The intensity of his attention seemed exposing, and I laughed a little. I was just starting to learn how to be looked at. I took a deep drink. The glass was full of vodka, cloudy with the barest slip of orange juice. I coughed. "Your parents let you drink?" I asked, wiping at my mouth. "I do what I want," he said, proud and uncertain at the same time. His eyes gleamed. I watched him decide what to say next. It was strange to watch someone else calibrate and worry over their actions instead of being the one who was worrying. Was this what Peter had felt around me? A limited patience, a sense of power that felt heady and slightly distressing. Teddy's freckled face, ruddy and eager. He was only 2 years younger than me, but the distance seemed definitive. I took a large swallow from the glass, and Teddy cleared his throat. "I have some dope if you want it," he said. Teddy led me to his room, expectant as I glanced around at his boyish novelties. They seemed arranged for viewing, though it was all junk. A captain's clock whose hands were dead. A long-forgotten ant farm, warped and molding. The glassy stipple of a partial arrowhead. A jar of pennies, green and scuzzy as sunken treasure. Usually I'd make some crack to Teddy. Ask him where he got the arrowhead. Or tell him about the whole one I'd found. The obsidian point sharp enough to draw blood. But I sensed a pressure to preserve a haughty coolness, like Suzanne that day in the park. I was already starting to understand that other people's admiration asked something of you, that you had to shape yourself around it. The weed Teddy produced from under his mattress was brown and crumbled, barely smokable, though he held out the plastic bag with gruff dignity. I laughed. "It's like dirt or something. No thanks." He seemed stung and stuffed the bag deep in his pocket. It had been his trump card, I understood, and he hadn't expected its failure. How long had the bag been there, crushed by the mattress, waiting for deployment? I suddenly felt sorry for Teddy. The neckline of his striped shirt gone limp with grime. I told myself there was still time to leave, to put down the now empty glass, to say a breezy thank you and go back to my own house. There were other ways to get money. But I stayed. He eyed me, sitting on his bed, with a bewildered and attentive air, as if looking away would break the rare spell of my presence. "I can get you some real stuff, if you want," I said. "Good stuff. I know a guy." His gratitude was embarrassing.
"Really?"
"Sure." I saw him notice as I adjusted my swimsuit strap. "You have any money on you?" I asked. He had $3 in his pocket, wadded and limp, and didn't hesitate to hand them over. I tucked the bills away, all business. Even possessing that small amount of money tindered an obsessive need in me, a desire to see how much I was worth. The equation excited me. You could be pretty. You could be wanted. And that could make you valuable. I appreciated the tidy commerce. And maybe it was something I already perceived in relationships with men. That creep of discomfort, of being tricked.
At least this way, the arrangement was put toward some use.
What about your parents? I said. Don't they have money somewhere?
He cut a quick glance at me.
They're gone, aren't they? I sighed, impatient. So who cares?
Teddy coughed, rearranged his face. Yeah, he said. Let me check. The dog banged at our heels while I followed Teddy up the stairs. The dimness of his parents' room, a room that seemed both familiar, the stale glass of water on the nightstand, the lacquered tray of perfume bottles, and foreign. His father's slacks collapsed in the corner, an upholstered bench at the foot of the bed. I was nervous, and I could tell Teddy was too. It seemed perverse to be in his parents' bedroom in the middle of the day. The sun was hot outside the shades, outlining them brightly. Teddy went into the closet in the far corner, and I followed. If I stayed close, I was less like an intruder. He reached up on his toes to feel blindly through a cardboard box. While he searched, I shuffled through the clothes hanging from fussy silken hangers. His mother's. Paisley pussy bow blouses. The grim, tight tweeds. They all seemed like costumes, impersonal and not quite real, until I pinched the sleeve of an ivory blouse. My mother had the same one, and it made me uneasy, the familiar gold of the I Magnon label like a rebuke. I dropped the shirt back on its hanger. Can't you hurry up? I hissed at Teddy. And he made a muffled reply, rummaging farther until he finally pulled out some new-looking bills. He shoved the box back onto the high shelf, breathing hard while I counted. 65, I said, neatening the stack, folding it to a more substantial thickness. Isn't that enough? I could tell by his face, the effort of his breathing, that if I demanded more, he would find a way to get it. Part of me almost wanted to gorge myself on this new power, see how long I could keep it going. But then Tiki trotted in the doorway, startling us both. The dog panting as he nudged at Teddy's legs. Even the dog's tongue was spotted, I saw. The crimped pink, freckled with black. This'll be fine, I said, putting the money in my pocket. My damp shorts gave off an itch of chlorine. So, when will I get the stuff? Teddy said. It took a second to understand the significant look he gave me. The dope I'd promised. I'd almost forgotten that I hadn't just demanded money. When he saw my expression, he corrected himself. I mean, no rush, if it takes time or whatever. Hard to say. Tiki was sniffing at my crotch. I pushed his nose away more roughly than I'd meant to, his snout wetting my palm. My desire to get out of the room was suddenly overwhelming. Pretty soon, probably, I said, starting to back toward the door. I'll bring it over when I get it. Oh, yeah, Teddy said. Yeah, okay. I had the uncomfortable sense at the front door that Teddy was the guest and I was the host. The wind chime over the porch, rippling a thin song. The sun and trees and blonde hills beyond seemed to promise great freedoms, and I could already start to forget what I'd done, washed over by other concerns. The pleasing, meaty rectangle of the folded bills in my pocket. When I looked at Teddy's freckled face, a surge of impulsive, virtuous affection passed through me. He was like a little brother. The gentle way he'd mothered the barn kitten. I'll see you, I said, leaning to kiss him on the cheek. I was congratulating myself for the sweetness of my gesture, the kindness. But then Teddy adjusted his hips, hunching them protectively. When I pulled away, I saw his erection pushing stubbornly against his jeans.